Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lisa Vorderbriggen, political editor and columnist for Contra Costa Newspapers and Media News, and the author of a blog, Inside Politics. And I'll be your chair for today's event. I'd also like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today is Arianna Huffington. She is here today to discuss her newest book, Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe. Born Arianna Stassinopoulos in Athens, Greece, Arianna Huffington has become a very famous voice in U.S. politics. She is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post and one of the nation's oft-cited political websites. She is a nationally syndicated columnist and the author of 11 books whose topics range from a personal roadmap for achieving fearlessness in life to, quote, Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. Many of us in California remember Huffington's run for California governor during the 2003 recall election, as well as her role in her Republican ex-husband Mike Huffington's unsuccessful 1994 bid for the U.S. Senate campaign. I'm like, whoa. Arianna was at one time a Republican. Today, she takes on the Republican administration with nearly unparalleled ferocity. But she is, without question, in my mind, one of the most fearless women on the American political landscape. Please join me in welcoming Arianna Huffington.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you for the introduction. And you know, the fact that you are dating my Republican years to the 1940s feels absolutely fine for me. In fact, it feels such a long time ago that in a way it is a long time ago. It's after all over 11 years, but it feels longer than that. After all, when I was a Republican, things were so different. Remember, Dick Cheney was still Saddam Hussein's good friend. Enron was still a great corporation, and Michael Jackson was still black. So that's how long ago it was. And it is true, I have been a fixture of sort of Californian politics and indeed the Commonwealth Club. But in case there are any of you here who have not heard me before, this accent is for real. I say that because after Tracy Ullman started imitating my accent rather well, I must say, people are wondering whether I'm also imitating my accent. The question really is why, since you've been living here since 1980, since you've gone to Cambridge and spent 12 years in England before that, why are you still speaking with an accent? My ex-husband's explanation is because I never listen. But then, that's what ex-husbands are supposed to say, right? I don't know what it is, but I know that when I first met Henry Kissinger, I went up to him and thanked him for making incomprehensibility acceptable in American public life. So now the accent, I suppose, is part of the brand, and what can we do? Here it is. I've stopped trying to change it. It is really great to be back here. Especially at this amazing moment in American politics when really so much is changing, the center is shifting, the people are ahead of our leaders and ahead of the media. And what I'm trying to do with this book is define what's happening, define the new center, and really accelerate the process of closing this dark chapter in American history, turning a new page and putting our country again back on the right course towards the goodness and greatness that are inherent in America's founding. I want to tell you a little bit about why I decided to write this book. The particular moment when I decided to do it was when I was watching one of the Republican primary debates. And the moderator asked the candidates to raise their hand if they did not believe in evolution. I don't know if you remember that moment. It was a pretty interesting moment in American politics. Three candidates raised their hand. And I was watching it with my two teenage daughters. And I really was hoping that somebody would come forward, escort the candidates off the stage, and tell them to go spend the next 4 years studying their science and come back and run for president 4 years from now. Instead, I kind of almost expected the moderator to ask the candidates to raise their hand if they did not believe in gravity. And maybe five of them would have raised their hand. Because the problem with the right is not that it is at odds with progressives or Democrats. The problem with the right is that it is at odds with reality. It is at odds with facts, with evidence, with science. And that's why it has been so dangerous. And that's why it has been so discredited. Basically, the right is now down to that 28% that still approves of George Bush. There are many disaffected Republicans, many probably in this room. There are many disaffected independents. And so the question that I'm asking in the book, then how come, since the right is shrinking and discredited, since the center has shifted and many of the so-called left-wing positions on bringing the troops home, on healthcare, on global warming, on corporate responsibility are now completely mainstream, then how come that the right is still dominating our policy and dictating the agenda? That is really the question that I'm trying to ask in the book. And I have come back with three main reasons. The first reason has to do with the media. I devote two chapters to the media. The first one is called Equal Time for Lies. Because the media, and when I talk about the media, I'm not just talking about Fox. It's not even worth dealing with Fox. You know, we all know Fox is fair and balanced and all is well with the world, right? My main issue is with the mainstream media. So the mainstream media remain addicted to the idea that every issue, every story has two sides. And their job is to present both sides and then let the public make up their minds, like Pontius Pilate washing off their hands of any responsibility to bring out the truth. Now, what is interesting is that my oldest daughter was the editor of her school paper this year. And she wrote a paper about how she saw her mission as a school editor. And she wrote things like, my mission is to ferret out the truth. And I thought to myself, yes, you know, I remember those words. I remember when journalism used to be about ferreting out the truth. And the truth is not found by splitting the difference between two points of view. The truth is often solidly on one side or the other, or it's lurking in the shadows. Yet the assumption is that somehow you present the two sides, you split the difference, you get to the truth. We've seen that again and again. My good friend Zem Joachim, who is a big activist on global warming, is here. And so Zem and I have talked a lot about the way the media have handled global warming. You've had, on the one hand, the equivalent of Al Gore talking about the dangers of global warming, and on the other hand, Senator James Inhofe or Michael Crichton telling us that global warming is a fraud, or some scientist in the pay of Exxon. And then the reporter could just wash his or her hands off, and the public would be presented with these two points of view. But these are not two points of view that are equally valid. Then why are we treating them as though they're equally valid? The same goes with Iraq. How many times haven't you seen Iraq described as a mixed bag? You know, John McCain goes back to Iraq. He cannot even go back to the place where he went last time and told us everything was fine in that market, forgetting to mention that he was surrounded by more soldiers than George Washington had at Valley Forge and three helicopters. But he could not even go there anymore. That's how dangerous it had become. So he goes back. He tells us the surge is working. I don't know how you can say the surge is working when violence has erupted everywhere. And yet, nevertheless, the reporters come back and report that Iraq is a mixed bag because they saw a soccer field somewhere over there. saying that Iraq is a mixed bag is a little bit like going to the doctor and the doctor tells you that you have a brain tumor, but your acne has cleared. And you come back and tell your family that this was a bit of a mixed bag of a diagnosis. But, you know, the right doesn't have to win these arguments. It simply has to spread doubt about what's happening, whether on Iraq or global warming or healthcare or any of the major issues we're facing. And when it comes to the economy, you know, the right loves the free market, right? Except when Bear Stearns is in trouble. Then somehow it rushes to government to save Bear Stearns. And that's fine. It's perfectly okay with me to use taxpayer funds to save Bear Stearns. But then why not use taxpayer funds to save the millions of American homeowners from losing their homes? Why is it okay for the free market to work with millions of ordinary Americans, but not for those in Wall Street? That is really the big question that we need to be asking ourselves right now, because it's not as if the right is consistent or coherent about what it believes. So that's one of the major reasons why we've gotten to the place where we are with the right. And one additional fact is the way the media keep presenting everything as right versus left. Have you noticed that? So being against the war is supposed to be a left-wing position. The fact that Senator Chuck Hagel, a very conservative senator, is passionately opposed to the war and one of the most eloquent critics of the Bush administration. The fact that Walter Jones, the conservative congressman who was responsible for renaming French fries, freedom fries, is opposing the war. The fact that Bill Buckley, before he died, was opposing the war. The fact that 60 to 70% of Americans are opposing the war. It still doesn't matter to the media. They're still presenting it as a left-wing position. Well, the left must have really expanded to include 60 to 70% of Americans. So this is my quick summary of why I blame the media for enabling what the right is doing. And some of my main poster children for that are some of the great journalists, supposedly, of this country when it comes to covering what is happening. Take Bob Woodward, for example. Bob Woodward was given unlimited access to the White House in the lead up to the war, and he wrote two books that completely missed the story. He told us in great detail how many mints were on the cabinet table, but he missed the story of the fact that we were misled to war. And then when the conventional wisdom moved, and Bob Woodward so much wanted to be part of the new conventional wisdom against the war, because otherwise he couldn't be at the grown-ups table, he just very simply wrote a new book, State of Denial, which basically completely changed what he was saying in the first two books. And it was as though it was George Bush who changed, instead of admitting that it was he who suddenly saw things differently the way they had been in 2002. And yet he went around doing all the shows without ever being held accountable for what he had written in his first two books. And that is really what is missing here, accountability. How else do you explain the fact that Bill Kristol gets everything wrong on the war, including telling us that we don't have to worry about Sunnis versus Shias because Iraq is a secular state, and I'm quoting, and yet he's rewarded with a regular column in the New York Times. How do you explain that except through some kind of self-loathing in the liberal media that make them feel that somehow they have to embrace the most discredited right-wing advocates? I'm not talking about having conservative columnists. Of course they should. But the most discredited right-wing advocates like Bill Kristol or Tony Snow, who was hired by CNN, or Karl Rove, who was hired by Newsweek. Okay, enough about the media. The second group of enablers are unfortunately the Democratic leaders, because there has, without question, been a lack of leadership, when it comes to clearly and equivocally telling the truth to the American people. That's why I loved it when, during his victory speech in North Carolina, Barack Obama said that what we need to do is tell the truth to the American people repeatedly and consistently. Repeatedly is a key thing, because the right has won by repeatedly lying to the American people. But you cannot counter that without repeatedly telling the truth. And I think we need to establish a certain kind of zero tolerance when it comes to the right using fear and using terrorism to undermine their opponents, whether it's George Bush calling effectively Obama an appeaser, although not using his name, but everybody knew what he was referring to, or whether it is Congressman King saying that Al-Qaeda will be dancing in the streets if Barack Obama wins. You know, these are the kind of arguments that they used against John Kerry, and they worked. Because, you know, fear will always trump everything else. I wrote a book on fearlessness, and I studied how fear works. And when fear is activated, it basically responds to a part of our brain that is known as the lizard brain. And when the lizard brain is activated, the rational brain goes into abeyance. So that way you can convince people that George Bush, the guy who clears brush in Crawford and is a kind of macho guy, will keep you safe. While John Kerry, the guy who windsurfs and drinks Chardonnay and has a French-speaking wife, will not. And they are trying it all over again with Obama. You can see how they are trying to present him as a feat and somebody who is not going to keep us safe, even though he had the judgment to know from the beginning that the war in Iraq was a tragic mistake. So the use of fear is something that has been so prevalent and so effective that Democratic leaders need to get much better at countering it without being cowed and without being intimidated. And the final point that I think has really enabled the right to succeed is amnesia. That's why we have created three posters which are in the book. They were actually created by a San Francisco-based, wonderful, brilliant advertising executive, Rich Silverstein. And he created those three posters to remind people at a glance of what the last 7.5 years have been like. The first is a poster of names. The second is a poster of people. And the third is a poster of slogans. And you'd be surprised how many you may have forgotten. You probably remember the axis of evil and slam dunk and shock and awe and mission accomplished and bring them on and stay the course and last throws and heck of a job brownie and I'm the decider and stuff happens, etc., etc. And then at the bottom we say, had enough yet? So I have them hanging in my office in New York and you can see immediately, you know, every day why they have to go. And you can also see why John McCain is nothing more than a third term by George Bush. And he's really running on a platform of more of the same, which, as far as I'm concerned, should disqualify him from holding sharp scissors, let alone being president of the United States. So if it were not for John McCain being the nominee, I would be pretty confident that the right's reign has come to an end. But John McCain is the Trojan horse of the right. And as a Greek, I know that Trojan horses are a big problem. So we really have to unmask him every day. Consistently, repeatedly, with passion, unmasking John McCain, convincing the American people that the John McCain they loved in 2000 does not exist anymore. He's not on the ballot in 2008. If you want to vote for John McCain, you need a time machine. Is there anybody here who wants to vote for John McCain? Be honest, it's okay. If there is anybody here who wants to vote for John McCain, I'll give you a free book. Because I'm absolutely convinced that by the end of it, you will no longer want to vote for John McCain. In fact, I actually have a money-back guarantee. If you give it... I'm going to ask a different question. Raise your hand if you know somebody wants to vote for John McCain. Exactly. That's my point. So give them a book, and if at the end of it they still want to vote for John McCain, they get their money back. I really believe so strongly that 20%, the difference between the 28% who don't approve of George Bush and the 48% who want to vote for John McCain, I really believe that 20% can be convinced that the John McCain they want to vote for does not exist. We just have to present them with the facts. The 28% that approves of George Bush and wants to vote for John McCain, I wouldn't bother with them. Life is too short. And we don't need to win unanimously. A good landslide will be sufficient. But in order to have a good landslide, we need to convince that 20% of disaffected Republicans, independents, misguided voters who have not really had their image of John McCain updated. So let me just end by giving you a quick overview of the fall of John McCain. It is a Shakespearean fall. It is not a flip-flopping, run-of-the-mill fall like Mitt Romney. Like, what did Mitt Romney ever really stand for, other than getting elected? John McCain stood for something. John McCain was a real leader, a real reformer. I remember traveling with him on the Straight Talk Express in New Hampshire and feeling, yes, I disagree with him on choice, I disagree with him on different issues, but that's a real leader. That's somebody who can really change America and really wants to. So what happened since then? He has basically surrendered to the right on every major issue, from tax cuts. Remember, he voted against them twice, and he actually said, I cannot in good conscience, very much a John McCain word, conscience, I cannot in good conscience vote for these tax cuts at a time of war. Now he wants to make them permanent. Then, on immigration, he has said he would not vote for his own immigration bill. On torture, this man was tortured himself, has voted against a bill that would prevent the CIA from using torture. On the agents of intolerance, remember he called the religious right the agents of intolerance, and then he went on and kissed their rings. So it's really tragic that a man has been willing to sell his soul to the right in order to get elected. And it is up to us to make absolutely sure that he's not. Thank you.
Our thanks to Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post and author of Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe. Ms. Huffington, we have a big stack of questions, and so we'll get started right away with the first one, which I found particularly intriguing. Would you accept a post... Guess which administration I'm going to mention here? The Obama administration, if he should take the White House. And if so, what would you like to do?
I actually really love my day job. I feel that I would be very content to end my days as the editor of the Huffington Post. I love the fact that we can every day... keep sort of expanding what we're doing. We are increasingly becoming an internet newspaper. Half our traffic comes from people who don't come to us because of politics, who come to us because of our section on media or entertainment or business or living. And I love to be able to speak not just to the people who agree with me, who agree with progressive viewpoints, but to people who are suddenly exposed to our points of view, even though they may be either apolitical or not sharing them. I've always never wanted just to talk to the choir. I've always wanted to expand the people who see the world based on the facts and the evidence that we can present at the Huffington Post. So it's kind of exciting when we get people coming because Perez Hilton, for example, linked to a blog by Ryan Reynolds one day, and we saw our traffic spike dramatically, and I'm sure a lot of the people who came to us had never heard of us before. I mean, you know, they go to Perez Hilton for their news. So other than the fact that my 16-year-old daughter was incredibly impressed that Perez Hilton mentioned the Huffington Post, we also saw the traffic pattern. We saw the number of people who continued to come to the Huffington Post after they discovered us. And that is very exciting to me, bringing in new readers, exposing them to politics. This is part of what has been exciting about this election. Over 3 million new registered Democrats. Unprecedented numbers of young people going out to vote. This is something incredibly exciting. And that's what has always appealed to me, the idea of expanding the electorate. I know I'm moving beyond the question, but that's an important point. There are 50% of eligible voters who don't regularly vote. So why fight over the 4 or 5% of swing voters? Why not go to that 50% of eligible non-voters and transform them into voters?
Now, speaking of young voters, tell us about what is the Huffington Post? There may be many people in the audience who haven't gone online and ventured to the whole new world of blogging.
The Huffington Post is a combination of a collective blog. We have about 2,000 bloggers, some in this audience, I'm happy to say. News, 24/7, constantly refreshed news, and community. We have hundreds of thousands of comments from all around the country, a very lively debate on the Huffington Post. And we are constantly adding features. Like one of our exciting new features is Off the Bus, which is our citizen journalism project, if anybody wants to be involved with that. We have people all around the country.
And you don't pay anybody, right? People do this out of the goodness of their hearts, no pay?
They do. Well, we pay our reporters, we pay our editors. We have over 50 people paid staff. Beth Ellis, who is here, who is our San Francisco advertising executive, is being paid, I hope, Beth. We pay our advertising team. So absolutely, we don't pay our bloggers. We believe that they write if they want to write. You know, they have no deadlines, there are no expectations. We instead provide them with a platform, with attention, with the technology, and moderated comments.
Just as a reminder to our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, and author of Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe. I'd like to move to a question of my own. I've listened for your, and I've been reading your book. You blame the Republicans. The media, that would be me, Democratic leaders, misguided voters. Who's left?
I have not blamed the voters, and I have separated the good guys in the media. I have a section in the book called The Honor Roll, and I deliberately give credit to the people who got it right. Because, you know, there are many people in the lead-up to the war who got it right. The Knight Reader investigative team got it right. Walter Pincus at the Washington Post got it right. Many got it right, but they got lost. They could not break through the static of the New York Times front-page stories by Judy Miller, writing about aluminum tubes and the nuclear threat in Iraq. And then the toxic recycling that went on. Dick Cheney would take the New York Times literally and go to meet the press and tell Tim Russert, look, it's not me saying that, It's the New York Times. The fact that Dick Cheney's office had fed the story to Judy Miller was part of the toxic recycling. And that's why I blame Tim Russert, and that's why I blame those who failed to ask the follow-up questions that would have given the truth to the American people. And that's why I continue to blame the media as enablers while singling out the guys who got it right and the girls.
So what's next, then, if these institutions, the Democratic leaders, the Republican leaders, the media as an institution, isn't getting it right on the whole? What's next?
Well, the great thing at the moment is that the blogosphere, the presence of online media, is changing that reality, because we can now challenge the mainstream media. And also, when the mainstream media break a great story, as the New York Times did recently with the Pentagon story, how the Pentagon has been conducting its mind war, basically misinforming, feeding misinformation to military analysts who would then go on TV and spread that misinformation to the American people. The New York Times published that above the fold on a Sunday and then dropped it. The mainstream media dropped it. We stayed on it. I don't mean just we, the Huffington Post. I mean we in the blogosphere. So by staying on it, we have led to congressional investigations and the demand for accountability. You see, that is for me the great, great service that the blogosphere, and I'm so glad, Lisa, you have a blog, can provide. Because on your blog, as you know, you can every day stay on a subject that you're interested in. And you're not going to have an editor who tells you, oh, Lisa, you wrote about that last week. Drop it. Right? So in the same way that the mainstream media suffer from ADD, attention deficit disorder, we in the blogosphere suffer from OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And you need OCD to really break through the static.
I'm all for OCD. That's good. For a question from the audience. What caused your shift in perspective from your more conservative days with Michael Huffington to your obviously more liberal progressive days today?
Alone. Actually, I wrote about this in a section in my book that I call My Name is Ariana and I'm a Former Republican. Basically, what prompted the shift was my confrontation with facts and evidence. That's why I'm so obsessed with facts and evidence, because if you really look at facts and evidence, you often have to change your mind, because you're often faced with new facts and evidence. That's what happened to me. When I was a Republican, I really believed Newt Gingrich. Okay, I know I shouldn't have believed Newt Gingrich, but I did. When he said in his first speech as speaker, and I quote it here in the book, he said that there is greater moral urgency in coming to grips with what's happening to the poorest Americans than in balancing the budget. And then he proceeded to cut Medicare in order to balance the budget. That was a new fact. I had to look at it. And there was a series of new facts like that that made me realize that the Republican Party was not my home. The final new fact that I write about was when I wrote a column in the syndicated column I had at the time, in which I said that I criticized the Republicans for criticizing the White House for losing the war on drugs. And I wrote in my column, you know, Republicans have been saying for years that we cannot win the war on poverty from Washington. Then how can they expect us to win the war on drugs from Washington? And Newt Gingrich cut my column from the Washington Times and wrote on the margin, this column is strategically counterproductive. What good does it do to take on your allies so soon before an election? And I thought to myself, strategically counterproductive? He didn't say it's wrong. He didn't say it's untrue. He said it's strategically counterproductive. It sounded completely Stalinist. And that was the end for me. I thought, I don't want to be part of a party where the truth is basically dispensable, and what matters is what is productive strategically and what is counterproductive strategically.
Now, since it took you a number of years to change your viewpoint, this member of the audience wants to know why you think your book will have any impact in changing people who may already agree with you or are simply reading, being preached to by the choir.
Well, obviously, there are some people who will read the book who already agree with me and are going to get a lot of new ammunition You can always use more ammunition during an election year. And there are others who read the book and discover a lot of new facts and evidence that make them change their mind, especially if they are still thinking of voting for John McCain. And I also believe that at the moment there is something very exciting happening in this country. We are going to have a man running for president in the Democratic Party who basically has been against this war from the beginning. I think that's very significant. I wrote today, actually, a blog that also says that Hillary Clinton has made a huge contribution in this campaign. And I use as an example my oldest daughter, who voted for Obama, her first vote in the California primary, but who every day says to me something incredibly admiring about Hillary Clinton. And I think that what is wonderful as a role model to young people, both girls and boys, who are so afraid of failure, is to see somebody who may have failed, if things continue the way they are, in her quest for the nomination, but has incredibly succeeded in changing the way women running for the presidency will be seen forever, and in also presenting an incredible role model to all of us about getting up every day when the odds are against you and keeping going. That is an admirable lesson, and many in the country are seeing that and being affected by it.
Now, that said, if you were a superdelegate, who would you be voting for come the Democratic Convention in Denver?
Oh, I sincerely hope that the superdelegates are not going to wait for Denver. I hope that the superdelegates are going to be making their minds fast and furiously right now and making sure that by the time we get to Denver, Barack Obama is the nominee. And I know there are many people in the audience who are Hillary supporters, and that these are the people that I'm addressing by saying that this is really now the moment to look at the math and where the math is.
So you're not going to tell us who endorsing or
you
not?
Obviously, Lisa, you obviously don't read me. Because, because if you have been reading me, you would not be asking me. It is very clear that I would prefer Barack Obama rather than Hillary Clinton to be the nominee. I have written that. But this is not to say, and that's why I wrote this blog today, that Hillary Clinton is not absolutely brilliant, disciplined, and has made a huge contribution in this campaign. And also, I think, has been herself transformed in this campaign. Another thing that is very important to realize is that the Clinton brand has been changed. And she's now the carrier of the Clinton brand and has many years ahead of her where she can be incredibly influential in American politics. But I think that for me, the main reason why I have favored Barack Obama is the war. And the fact that Hillary Clinton voted for the war and Barack Obama opposed it from the beginning is, for me, very significant when this election is going to be about national security and when John McCain is going to be a huge supporter of the war. So we are going to be able to have this clear difference, this clear juxtaposition of two dramatically different points of view.
Again, for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, and author of Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe. Now, you mentioned the war and the war issues, and one of our audience members would like to know if you foresee any criminal action being taken against George Bush, Dick Cheney, specifically, the audience member mentions the torture approval, which you referred to earlier. And is it possible that Rove will be arrested?
A girl can dream. let me just first of all say that I believe that criminal action would have been very appropriate in the sense that what they have done with Abu Ghraib, with Guantanamo, with our civil liberties, have basically been completely against the American Constitution and what America stands for. At the same time, what I would like right now more than anything is to turn a page and move on and hold accountable the people who want to continue to have a role to play in American life. I think that the people like Paul Wolfowitz, for example, being somehow made the head of the World Bank before he got in trouble with his girlfriend. You know, that's what I think needs to stop. And we can do that without criminal action, simply by holding them accountable, by demanding accountability. And the media have a huge role to play. A couple of weeks ago, there was a story in the New York Times, and the headline was, "We've asked foreign policy experts to write, to give us their opinion about what we should do in Iraq." And one of the so-called foreign policy experts was Richard Perle. Richard Perle is one of the architects of the Iraq War. We're now going to him for advice, what to do with Iraq. You know, that's really what the media are suffering from, amnesia and from lack of demanding accountability. So I think that's what is incredibly important.
Another audience member would like to know, is there a world leader today that perhaps could bring the nations together, as you've just mentioned, rather than continue to fragment us, as appears to be the case today?
Yes, I think that leader is Barack Obama. I think that the day after Obama is elected, it's the signal being sent across the world is going to be incredibly significant. Because, you know, this is going to be a man called Barack Hussein Obama. Is there anybody here who does not know his middle name is Hussein? Do you know John McCain's middle name? And that's very significant, because that's what this election is going to come down to, swift voting Barack Obama, trying to make him appear as though he's Muslim or anti-Israel or an appeaser, all these things. But nevertheless, assuming he survives the swift voting and is elected, the message that will be sent around the world that wants to love America but has found it hard to love America during the Bush years is going to be very significant. And all the Hillary Clinton supporters who are undoubtedly disappointed, there's no question about that, will recognize, I have no doubt, that the alternative, which is electing John McCain, is not something the country can afford. You know, it's like when you have no credit in the bank, you can't afford another mistake.
What do you think will be the biggest hurdle for Obama, should he, or the Democratic nominee, facing John McCain?
The biggest hurdle is going to be the media that continue to present John McCain as somebody who is strong on national security. And I want you to stay with me for a minute. Why is somebody who has consistently supported the wrong policy on Iraq, that has made this country less safe, why is that somebody supposed to be strong on national security? That's what I don't understand. And yet, if you watch the shows like yesterday, I now really have to sort of calm myself down as I watch all these interviewers who ask the same question, and the assumption is always, you know, John McCain is so strong on national security. Why? So that's really the question that we all need to be asking, because that's the misunderstanding, that's the meme that we need to overcome, which will clearly demonstrate that the person against the wrong decision, the person who would have kept our eye on the ball, which was getting Osama bin Laden, remember Osama bin Laden? That would have not allowed Afghanistan to collapse into the chaos it's collapsing into now, that would not have allowed Iran to be infinitely more powerful now than before George Bush was in the White House, that's the person who is stronger on national security.
Now, you made mention on your blog, and you say I don't read you, but I do, that John McCain and Cindy McCain actually told you they didn't vote for George Bush. Why does that matter? Why would we care?
Well, first of all, it matters because he's now saying that he did vote for George Bush, so he's lying, because I was not the only one who said that. There were three other people at that dinner, two of them on the record, Brad Whitford and Richard Schiff, said that they heard him say the same thing. The third one off the record, because she didn't want to upset the McCains, said that she heard it. So that's significant, since you're supposed to be the owner of the Straight Talk brand. But the other more significant reason, and why I wrote this post, is the fact that that John McCain, who so abhorred George Bush, he could not even bring himself to vote for him, is the person we love. You know, because he was so, he could not bear him.
Won't that help him now, given the general public's opinion about George Bush?
I don't think it will help him since he's disowned it. In fact, for about a week after I wrote the story, we had John McCain, who desperately needs to distance himself from George Bush, having to repeat how much he likes George Bush. I voted for him. I campaigned for him. I support him. So that was a good moment.
One of our audience members says, don't you think that John McCain is agreeing to agree with the far right and will return to his old self after he's elected?
This is not a risk we can afford to take. I think we have to take him at his word. I think a man who so deeply gives up who he is, the core of his beliefs, I don't even know where he's going to find them again. When you give up your soul, it's very hard to find it again. I mean, I believe in redemption. I just don't think this country can take the risk.
To do a little bit of a shift in subject here, one of our audience members would like to know, what's your take on Governor Schwarzenegger? And talk about someone who's undergone a political evolution. And he has an accent, too. So you guys have something in common. How has he changed since coming into office?
Well, you know, let's just look at the last thing that Arnold Schwarzenegger did, which was to cut budget deficits from the poorest, most needy Californians and say that he had to because we didn't have any money, while at the same time he's preserving major corporate loopholes, including a tax loophole on owners of yachts. Now, I love owners of yachts, but I think they can afford to pay their fair share of taxes if they can afford a yacht. And so that is really, for me, the discrepancy. You know, it's one thing to talk a moderate language, but it's another thing to practice it. And we have the same problem with John McCain. You know, it's one thing to go on Saturday Night Live and appear charming. You know, we are not getting a prom date. We are voting for a president of the United States. So he can. So this, and the same applies to both of them.
Would you ever consider, this audience member wants to know, belonging or becoming a Republican again?
No, why would I?
Well, that was easy. Another member of audience, thank you for all that you do. Your work is very important and you do a very good job. Thank you for coming here today. And the question is, if Obama or Clinton is elected, do you think what is left of the right still in office will try to destroy the new administration like they tried to do the Clintons from day one? Or do you think that the right will show signs of accepting this change?
Well, first of all, the good news is that the right has shrunk. The right is discredited. We've seen that in the last few months. We've seen Republicans lose three seats that were seen as Republican strongholds. You know, they lost Danny Hastert's seat, they lost in Louisiana, they lost in Mississippi. You know, a Republican congressman said that if the Republican brand was dog food, it would have been taken off the shelves. So clearly, we are dealing with a major problem in the Republican Party, and they're finally beginning to recognize it. So I think more and more we'll see the light. And the ones who remain, you know, the Rush Limbaughs and Ann Coulters, you know, really they are toxic curiosities. And the only reason they have any kind of credence is because the mainstream media give them credence. Why is the Today Show hosting Ann Coulter? I have a list here of some of the I have a list of some of the things that Ann Coulter has said. You know, again, I think you may forget these things, but let me just give you a few reminders. Liberals hate America. Democrats actually hate working class people. Even Islamic terrorists don't hate America like liberals do. Liberals can't just come out and say they want to take more of our money, kill babies, and discriminate on the basis of race. Islam is a car-burning cult. Let me just read you one more. I don't want to... spoil your afternoon.
Yeah, we haven't had lunch yet.
Isn't it great to see Muslims celebrating something other than the slaughter of Americans? So basically, that's who she is. That's the stuff she says. So why give her any credence by inviting her to be on CNN or the Today Show or any of the things? She can go speak. I mean, there's free speech. But shows choose who to have on. So why basically give her the kind of credibility that otherwise she would be totally lacking?
So the media doesn't get to decide who's credible. You get to decide who's credible? Is that how this works?
No, I don't. You know, do you think the remarks I just read are credible?
Absolutely not.
Then? You're a member of the media.
Fortunately, so I don't work for CNN, but...
No, but it's the same thing. Yeah. If you think these remarks are credible, put her on your show. If you don't, why are you putting her on your show?
There are many people out there who would consider none of your remarks credible and wouldn't have you on. So I'm just bringing up the point that you have polarized views. How are you any different than the far right making polarized comments?
Well, you would have to mention to me my comments that you think are polarizing or extreme or not based on facts.
Well, the title of your book's pretty in How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America. That's not a little bit inflammatory, Ariana?
I consider it completely factual. And I have written... Not only that, but I have 388 pages backing it up.
Well, I'm not dumb enough to get into a war of the words with Ariana Huffington, so we'll do a radio reminder. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Ariana Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, and author of Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution, and Made Us All Less Safe. So let's go into our next question. How do you think the Reverend Wright issue will or will it hurt Senator Obama if he should make it to the general election?
Well, the fact that the mainstream media bought into the right-wing's talking points about Reverend Wright is also what I'm talking about. Just look at the ABC debate. You have two card-carrying members of the liberal media, George Stephanopoulos and Charlie Gibson, spending the first part of the debate discussing whether Barack Obama is a patriot, given that he was not wearing a flag lapel pin, which incidentally neither George or Charlie were wearing. Whether the fact that he had known a 60s radical, Bill Ayer, somehow disqualified him from being president, and the endless loop around Reverend Wright. Now, these are not issues that are going to affect American lives at all, and yet the liberal media have bought into how important they are. I think the fact that that Barack Obama did not immediately completely denounce Reverend Wright is an indication of, I think, how we would all behave towards somebody that we're close to who said things with which we disagreed. The fact that he ended up denouncing him was a recognition of American politics and how, unless he had denounced him, he would not have been able to move beyond this issue.
What's your theory on why Hillary Clinton is still in this race when it appears that she has lost?
Well, she is in this race, but she's in this race in a very different way, if you notice. She's in this race running against John McCain, not Barack Obama. She has not said anything negative against Barack Obama since the West Virginia victory. Indeed, she said very positive things about him in her West Virginia victory speech, which was a remarkable victory. You know, she beat him by 40%. And she's staying in this race. She's going to win in Kentucky. She's basically going to decide at what point she's going to leave. But all that matters in terms of democratic unity is how she's running her campaign. And she's running it right now in a way that makes it clear that she thinks the highest priority is to unite the party. She has said again and again that she hopes all her supporters and that she's going to work hard for that will go to the nominee, if that is Barack Obama.
Now, given your prolific history of books, articles, and your various works on the Huffington Post, how would you summarize your impact on the American political scene?
Enormous.
Another media softball.
Look how well things are going. Can you imagine where we would be without me? Probably completely mired in Iraq with millions of people losing their homes. Now, it's really impossible to know what impact you have. I think what keeps me going is the fact that I believe in the fact that there is a critical mass that needs to be reached before change happens. And the critical mass is never everybody, but it's just sufficient numbers of people seeing the truth and changing course. And I think everything all of us do that gets us closer to that critical mass is worthwhile. If we change the mind of one person a day or even a week, it's worthwhile. And that's why I think the idea of the tipping point, the critical mass, whatever term you want to use, is for me spiritually the equivalent of grace. Like, we do our part and then grace does the rest. You know, I don't believe that we are the ones who are going to need to bring it all to some perfect ending. I think we all need to do our part. And that's why I think the most significant thing I can do is encourage others to do their part. Because increasingly, we all need to stop looking for a knight on a white charger to save us and look into the mirror and discover our own leadership potential, discover the leader within. And that's the way that we can change the world.
Who would you like to see come forward as the vice presidential nominee, specifically for the Democratic Party, but I'm going to add the Republican Party as well. Who do you see coming forward on the VP ticket?
On the Democratic side, I would love to see Jim Webb. Senator Webb, who is a veteran, whose son is in Iraq at the moment, who actually has a great new book out, who has introduced a new GI Bill to offer educational benefits to the Iraq vets, a bill, incidentally, that John McCain is against, and don't you forget that. And the fact that he is somebody with solid national security credentials, who agrees with Barack Obama on the big issues, I think that would be significant. As for the Republican Party, I don't think that there is anybody, however great, who can mitigate the presence of John McCain at the top of the ticket. So it doesn't really matter who they choose. This is not a ticket that anybody who cares about this country should vote for.
Mike Huckabee went on TV yesterday asking for the job, rather obviously. What would you think, what would a Huckabee-McCain ticket, do you think that would help or hurt John McCain?
You know what I thought was amazing? I thought it was amazing that 2 days after Mike Huckabee had made that joke about Barack Obama being targeted with a gun, he was allowed on a national television show. I thought it was disgraceful. If I were Tim Russert, I would have canceled the invitation. There should be absolutely zero tolerance for joking about shooting a presidential candidate, especially an African-American presidential candidate, given the history of violence in this country.
You made a reference to it. Which is more powerful in American politics, racism or sexism?
Well, it appears that it is racism because we've had about 16% of Americans who said in West Virginia that racism was important in the decision they make. I sincerely hope that just the candidacy of a Barack Obama is going to change some of that. I lived in England when Margaret Thatcher was elected prime minister, and it was kind of extraordinary because the day before, you're reading everywhere how impossible it would be for the Brits to elect a woman. It goes against the history, against the sexism of the country. And the hour after she was elected, it was as though sexism had never existed. So I believe some of the same is going to happen once Barack Obama is elected.
What about you? Would you like to run for president?
Well, you're all safe because I wasn't born in this country.
Oh, that's right. She has the same problem as Schwarzenegger, right?
Yes. So, yeah.
And now, to move to the next question, since impeachment has been declared off the table by the Speaker, do you think John Edwards would or should pursue convictions of some of these Republican administration members if he becomes the next Attorney General?
You know what? I would like to see accountability being brought about by the way those who are responsible for what has happened are being treated in the media, in what jobs they're given, in the way that I would like to see all our energy being focused on solving the major problems we're facing right now. Remember what happened when Bill Clinton was impeached for something infinitely more pleasurable than invading a country. But nevertheless, the point is that it was a huge distraction. And so right now, we cannot afford to be distracted. We need to have every ounce of energy, intelligence, and creativity directed towards the massive problems this administration has really brought to this country, you know, ranging from what's happening in Iraq to our crumbling infrastructure to the millions of people losing their homes. All these are issues which will require literally every ounce of energy and creativity we have, and we should not be distracted.
Well, this audience really seems to want you to run for public office somewhere. Yet another question about a race you should run for. Would you ever consider running for Dianne Feinstein's seat in the U.S. Senate?
Let me just say absolutely unequivocally, I will never run for anything. I really love the freedom and the creativity that I have in my current job, and the way that I can be part of the new media revolution, which is constantly changing the landscape. And so that's something which I'm so grateful for and feel so blessed to be where I am right now that I'm staying.
Mm-hmm. What's your argument for why Republicans should vote Democrat this fall?
Any Republican who cares for their country, who cares for their children, who wants to see this country safer, more prosperous, should vote Democrat. And the evidence is so overwhelming. And in the book, you know, chapter by chapter, I deal with every issue, whether it's the economy, immigration, energy. And just if you look at what the right has done and what needs to be done, there's no argument here. Now, at the same time, we need to hold Democratic leaders accountable. We saw what happened in 06. You know, Democrats won Congress because of the clear mandate to bring the troops home. And instead, what happened? We surged. So it is absolutely imperative that we send a very clear message and continue day in, day out to hold them accountable about what needs to be done. So it's not as if Democrats get elected and suddenly all is well in the world. It's not like that at all, because Democrats could have done a lot more in the House and the Senate. Remember, the Constitution gives them the power of the purse. They could have said, we're going to fund to bring the troops home safely and responsibly, and we're not going to give you another penny. And they could have done that, and they didn't.
Another member of the audience would like to know, are you concerned that voting machines could steal the elections this November?
I'm very concerned about voting machines. That's why I said we want a landslide, because voting machines can mess with a squeaker, but they can't mess with a landslide. And right now, the Republican nominee needs to be defeated in a landslide. And it's one of those historic moments when all the evidence is stacked against them. And if we have a landslide, then once the Democrats are elected, we need to make it a priority to fix the voting system.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. Tell us the title of your next book. What are you working on?
You know, every time I finish a book, this is my 12th, I think I'm never going to write another one. It's like childbirth, you know, it's such a painful process, kind of fitting into everything else in my life. So I have no plans to write another book, but I'm not unequivocally saying that I will not. I just feel that my last two books are kind of like companion pieces. The book on overcoming fear and the book on the right. Because the right has used fear as the main weapon to manipulate the electorate and win power. So the more fearless we become in our own lives, the more able and clear-headed we're going to be to defeat the right come November and beyond. Thank you.
Our thanks to Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post and author of Right is Wrong, How the Lunatic Fringe Hijacked America, Shredded the Constitution and Made Us All Less Safe. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Lisa Vorderbriggen. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.